You may be wondering who I am. I'll just give you a real quick background by way of segueing into something else. 25 years ago, well, a long, long time ago, 1962, my parents moved here. 25 years ago, I was the marketing director, one of a series of failed marketing directors for the Center for Health Promotion in the building next door, working for some guy named Dick Hart, trying to figure out how to get people to purchase something that they fundamentally didn't want. And I wasn't the only one who couldn't figure that out. It turns out that people actually do want it, but not until they've paid for it and used it for a while. And there's just no point in, there's no point of traction to make a sale. It's something that people still haven't figured out. Got married, which is a really good story. And I'm not going to burden you with a long story. I'll burden you with a short story. I was a youth leader up on the Campus Hill Church. Something called Young Adventist Ministries, YAM, a really bad name. And we approached the pastor and said, hey, we'd like to have a mission trip down to San Felipe, Mexico. And the youth pastor was Hispanic. He said, yeah. He said, let's do that. He said, I need a detailed budget from you, and I need, you know, you need to write it out. I'm going to take it to the board. He said, but be very careful, because once you put something on that budget and they approve it, you can't change it. So think things through. So we did. We were very careful, you know, van, gasoline, food, all that stuff. And it was approved, and my buddies and I went and made up a bunch of copies, 700 copies of flyers, so that we could distribute them around campus and go. And we went to the girls' dorm, and we said, well, how many flyers do you need? And they said, 630. Ooh, this is really bad. 630. We only had only printed 700, and we were panicked for a moment. What on earth are we going to do? Because how are we going to tell guys we're going? And then we realized that we didn't really need to tell the guys. Seven guys, 34 young women. It was the dream trip for the men, anyway. Two marriages came out of that trip. So, guys, now you know how to do it. But anyway, met my wife, married, left here to go to La Vida Mission in New Mexico, working among the Navajo. Went from there to Mongolia, the first country director for the Adventist Development Relief Agency, ADRA. And in each of the places that I went, La Vida Mission, Mongolia, I saw things and experienced things which I covered last night, so I won't cover them tonight. But I saw things and experienced things that were fundamental in forming my thinking around my book, which I guess I should pull out and flash, just so Review and Herald knows I'm doing my job promoting the book. But from Mongolia, went next door to China, where I saw, again, momentous things taking place in society, resource constraints that were profound, population pressures that were profound, watching the accelerating decline of natural systems and how they impacted that densely populated society. From China, we eventually returned to the U.S. and settled in Maine, and for 11 years, I worked in the biorefining technology development sector, figuring out and deploying and trying to raise money for and do the whole thing, build models and eventually build factories that would turn trees into fuel and chemicals. And that was fascinating, and of course it had environmental aspects, and I was dealing with a lot of stuff there that was germane to the book. And then through a very strange twist of events, I left that sector. In retrospect, definitely the Lord leading, but I didn't see it at the time. Left that sector, finished this book, had it published, and became the Trust Services and Stewardship Director for the Northern New England Conference. So now, somewhat astonishingly, I'm a conference guy. I didn't see that coming. But the Lord works in amazing ways, and one of the interesting things is, before I joined the conference, I was trying to give this presentation in as many places as possible. And some places were quite open, you know. Yeah, come on. Yeah, we'll take up an offering, we'll pay your gas, whatever. Some places absolutely wouldn't hear of having me come. The last thing we need is an end-timey guy getting the congregation all stirred up about how Jesus is coming. Just stay away. These are Adventist churches, you know. Just stay away. We don't need you. And we don't know who you are, and man, you're just one of those. But when I became a conference employee, all of that stopped. Oh, you're from the conference. Well, you know, and the door's open. So it's kind of strange. I mean, I changed business cards, and all of a sudden they trust me. It's like, I don't know what's up with that. Anyway, for those of you who find that you wish you had seen last night's presentation, as you've been told, it's being recorded. It's available. But also, I'm at Mentone Church next weekend. Same thing. Don't come from the sermon. You already heard the sermon. You've already heard this one. But Friday night, if you decide you want to see the whole thing, Friday night at 7, come. You're quite welcome. Or if you find that there's something here to recommend to others, please do. Though it's a bit crowded over there, everyone is welcome. And there'll be a... Next weekend, it's 7 o'clock Friday night. And then the Sabbath sermon. Excuse me. Sorry. And then 2 o'clock after potluck is the afternoon session. Okay. Let's keep going. Those of you who weren't here last night, my tendency is to try and review last night, but I've done that before and it drags out and no one's happy. I'm just going to keep going, so I'll try, you know. Anyway, last night we went through global system decline. We went through the systems that God created during creation week and how those are visibly, measurably, through scientific analysis, being shown to be in steep and accelerating decline. We talked a little bit about how our society is built solidly on top of these systems that are crashing. Then today we're talking about these two bottom pyramids, resource depletion and complex society collapse. These forces from these three different directions are each and individually driving us toward the fulfillment of prophecy. We're seeing the fulfillment of prophecy with each of these, but together they're driving us inexorably toward the time of little trouble. Those events that happened before the close of probation, those events that Christ talked about in our foundation text, Matthew 24. 6 through 8. So we're going to be talking about the decline of global man-made systems, critical systems that underpin our global complex society, oil and money. We're going to be talking about resource shortages, including a number of resources, perhaps several critical resources you've probably never heard of. We're going to be talking about complex societies, and that's a little bit like talking to fish about water. We all live in one. We don't recognize it. We don't see the pattern. We don't know what's happening. And it's perfectly understandable. Complex societies have two really bad habits. Every one of them that has ever been known to exist has collapsed. Every one of them, before it collapsed, went to war. Now, there may be some societies, complex societies, that we don't know about. I'm sure there are. Maybe a few escape this pattern, but the trend is very, very firm. So we're also going to be talking about the destruction of false gods. We're going to be talking about what is going on Earth in the days to come and the parallels to the Israelites leaving Egypt. How God trounced and humiliated the gods of Egypt, and what that has to do with today and the time of little trouble. We're also going to be talking about what we should be doing at this time in history, what we can do. And I said last night, almost all of my recommendations are spiritual. You won't hear about food in your basement. In fact, if you read Ellen White, she says, don't do that. Absolutely don't do it. You're supposed to be relying on the Lord. You're not going to hear about how big a gun you should be buying, you know, or how you can put the right stuff in gasoline to stabilize it so when it's really time of trouble that 5 gallons of gasoline hasn't gone bad and still running your car. None of that. None of that. What you're going to be hearing about at the end is whether or not you have a friend you can trust in a really difficult situation. Is Jesus your friend? Because that's who we trust in difficult situations. We turn to friends. Is he a concept or is he a friend? So, let's go. Oil and money. Oil has given mankind more power than he's ever had. We terraform. We reform the surface of the earth, not just with our societies. I don't know how many of you have ever heard of the Los Plateau Project, L-O-E-S-S, Los Plateau Project in China. They took a massive area, I mean far bigger than Rhode Island, and they terraformed it. They did their hydraulic studies. They put in valleys where there weren't valleys. They put in hills where there weren't hills. They were trying to recreate the land because of absolute devastation from overgrazing and long-term stuff, and blah, blah, blah. And they did it, and it seems like it has worked, and they're beginning to do some of it in Africa. We are reforming the earth. We are gods with a lowercase g. What we set our mind to do, we can mostly do. And it's as a result of having amazing power at our fingertips. We've got amazing buildings. We've got amazing technology up there in the medical center. We've got an astonishing global complex society that runs on oil. If we didn't have hydrocarbons, oil, gas, and of course coal, what would we be doing? What would we be doing? I mean, where would our technology be? Where would our society be? This has been an extraordinary catalyst. And we built these complex societies in order to glorify God, right? This is Hong Kong, where I used to live, shot from Victoria Peak. I didn't take that picture, but I recognize it. Beautiful city at night. How many of you have been to Hong Kong? Well, then you know that it's called the land of 1,000 stinks. Looks great, but man, whoever took that picture is very likely sweating from walking up that hill. It's probably about 84 degrees and 99% humidity. Anyway, interesting place. Ground zero for global mammonism. That city is all about money, all day long, every day, all year. That's what Hong Kong is about. And not to pick on Hong Kong, L.A., San Diego, Portland, Maine, though to a lesser extent. But we're smaller. We're catching up. But we've built complex societies, and what we've done is we've insulated ourselves from God. We've used our power to push him away. We have become more and more and more self-reliant. Who needs to rely on God when we can solve the problem ourselves? We've come up with a series of brilliant solutions that ultimately creates much, much, much bigger problems. In the end, we actually do need God. We're actually not that great. But we pushed God aside and pursued, gentlemen, the desires of our hearts. Who knows what kind of car that is? I think I heard Lamborghini. You're forgiven for thinking it might be a Ferrari. Of course, the angle isn't clear, so, you know. But yeah, it's a Lamborghini, according to the photo that I use. I don't have any personal knowledge. But I used to use a slide, and I couldn't get permission to use it. I couldn't find who owned it. And I'm being more and more careful about that thing because I'm here in town to tape a DVD series with LLBN. I'll talk more about that in a minute. And so whatever I was using was going to be on the air. And the picture had beautiful jet plane with the private jet, with the stairs down and the pilot waiting, a beautiful Ferrari, and a woman in a, could only be described as a very expensive dress with a very expensive handbag and a very ugly little dog. And I would look at the plane, and I'd look at the woman, and I'd look at the car, and all three of them screamed high maintenance. So we tend to make our own problems. But we've used our power to pursue things that glorify us. We've used our power to uplift and ennoble ourselves. We've used our power to pursue our vanity at great cost. 7 billion people went through this last night. Those of you who were here last night, don't shout out the answer. How many of you students of history know what happened right about here? I heard it. Industrial Revolution. Absolutely. And the Industrial Revolution early on was powered by water wheels, you know, and it was a very small, very modest thing, turning out textiles. But as soon as it really started getting into some serious coal, and especially some serious oil, and especially some serious oil and gas, boom, it took off. We produced astonishing amounts of very cheap food. And as with any natural system, a superabundance of food means a superabundance of population. We went through all that last night. I won't spend time on it now. But this graph is entirely dependent on oil. It exists. This curve exists because of oil and this astonishing amount of oil that is embodied in our food. If we didn't use oil in industrial agriculture, we would have a 90% reduction in our global harvest. 90% reduction in our global harvest. So we rely in so many ways on oil, and that's a problem because there's only so much of it. Now, this graph was generated by the work of a guy, the intellectual heirs, really, of a guy named King Hubbert. It's called the Hubbert Curve. You might have heard of it. King Hubbert was working back in the 20s, 30s, 40s and 50s, I believe. And he was an oil field geologist. And he started out by describing the production curve up and down for a single oil well. Went on to describe the production curve for an entire oil field. And he was very good at it. Oil companies were astonished. You know, okay, I mean, he can figure it out. And we know when we need to drill more. And this is really great. He started working on the Hubbert curve for global oil supply. Passed away, and his intellectual heirs finished it. Global oil supply, because of areas that haven't been adequately looked at, discovered, is a bit dicey, and yet it's not so risky because the easy oil has long since been found. And what you see is that the Hubbert curve predicts that we start finding less and less oil right about Now, this particular curve is probably wrong by at least a little bit because it didn't take into account fracking. And fracking, it turns out, makes only a little difference. Here you see the amount of oil that's been discovered. That is the dramatic decline from the 1940s to the current era. And in the dark black line, you see global production. It doesn't take much to say, okay, those two trends are in conflict. We haven't used everything we've discovered. Certainly there's been a tremendous amount of oil in the Middle East that was discovered long ago and it's still there, but nowhere near enough to survive to supply the huge amount, 80 million barrels a day, 88 million barrels a day now, that the world uses. The Middle East is just a fraction of that number. Now this, I couldn't find a graph that reflected fracking. It's so frustrating. But what we see here in 2008 through the current is one more of these spikes, equaling, perhaps slightly exceeding, the last spike. The United States, where most of the fracking oil is produced right now, is by far the world leader in fracking, and we've had a dramatic decrease in the amount of oil that we import. So we're in great shape, right? The problem is that this substance that our global complex society is so reliant on is in demand by everyone else, and we've only got just a little spike. And at the same time, what we're finding is that fracking wells only last a few years. Got a sharp spike and a sharp drop. And they have to keep drilling as fast as they can. And it costs about $80 a barrel to do everything it takes to get that oil up. And they drilled the most productive wells first. They picked the low-hanging fruit as far as they could tell. So from everything we see with a few years of experience, this phenomenon looks like it'll be short-lived. In the meantime, we continue diverging. We're using more and more oil every day. Now, this is a price trend. The oil price from January 08 to actually January 2013. It includes all of 08 and includes all of 12. Looking at this chart, who can tell me what year had the highest price for the year average? Well, I heard a lot of stuff. Who says 08? Okay, you're wrong. No offense. Come on, you knew the first one wouldn't be right. Come on. Yeah, it looks like 11, doesn't it? Not quite. Very close. Last year was the highest ever year-long average price for gas, for oil, on the tail end of a global recession. There is so much growth in developing economies, especially in China, so much demand for this stuff. And look at during the recession. I mean, granted, we tailed off of an absurd high, but we corrected soon enough. You don't really see, in my opinion anyway, this price chart does not reflect the up and down cycle that we saw with our global recession, the Great Recession. We see tremendous demand and high prices. Oil, by the way, is up to $106 a barrel. It's up, I think, 13% in the last 10 days for a variety of reasons, which would bore you, I think. But that means you'll be paying about $4.40 in about 6 weeks. The price of oil goes up. It flows through the refineries. Each shipload of oil is more expensive. This is how it works. It takes weeks to flow through, but it's easy to say what it's going to be in about 6 weeks just by looking at the price now. For those of you who were here last night, we talked about how there's an ironclad link between the price of food and the price of oil. It takes about 6 months to work through that system. But again, we've got 3.5 billion people making less than $2.50 a day, and the price of their food just went up about 15%. You drive past the gas station and go, but these are people who can only buy the absolute minimum to live on, well, some of them anyway, especially those making a dollar a day or less, and there are hundreds of millions of people in that category. We're talking about significant suffering with our modest little bit of pain at $4.30 a gallon. All of this is connected. The last night we went through global system decline. We talked about many things. We talked about disruptions in natural systems. And interestingly enough, aside from everything else, disruptions in our natural systems also disrupt our ability to get and distribute oil. So aside from all these other problems, we've got convergent problems, I guess, is the point, when it comes to oil. We really, really, really need it. It's getting more and more expensive, and we're very, very willing to compete for it. Very willing to compete. Some of you may know that the significant supply of oil in Iraq had no small amount to do with the decision to invade. Who has that oil now?
China.
Yeah, China. We're better warriors, they're better businessmen. It cost us $13 trillion for the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. We're not getting that money back. We're going to talk about our global financial system in a few minutes. This is a train in, I think it's Tanzania. I'm pretty sure it's Tanzania. And it's a completely unremarkable train with the usual graffiti, loaded with a completely unremarkable dark brown rock that you probably have never heard of. This is phosphate rock. Only six countries produce it in commercial quantity. I beg your pardon. Canada is one. The U.S. doesn't produce that much of it, actually. China is one. Though China has, I wouldn't say they've stopped producing it, but they've passed laws that make it financially absurd to try and mine it and export it in China. So they kind of, in a way to avoid confrontation, they shut their system down because there's only a 25-year supply. Less than a 25-year supply now, actually. Phosphate is part of fertilizer. Those of you who were here last night, we talked about our global food production, soil, and how we've turned soil into dirt, something that was living into something that's dead. And the dirt around the world absolutely has to have inputs. With our new breeds of plants that are so thirsty, it takes massive amounts of water, which we're running out of, pumping out our aquifers. It takes tremendous amounts of fertilizer. You can have nitrogen, but if you don't have phosphate, if you don't have balanced fertilizer, don't bother. And you can see pretty plainly in the picture, you get more than a 90% decrease in output if you don't have phosphate. 25-year supply. In the last 6 years, the price of phosphate rock has gone up 600%. And now it is a meaningful price, part of the price of food, and it's going to keep going up. And the poor are going to become more and more and more pressed. So nations have to have phosphate rock. They have to have metals, minerals, rare earth minerals. The country I used to live in, Mongolia, was a very quiet, sleepy, backward country. It was hermetically sealed by the Soviet Union. They had no concept what the outside world was like. And the Soviet Union, when they went to Mongolia, they controlled Mongolia. Though it remained in name an independent nation because they needed one more UN vote. But it wasn't an independent nation in any meaningful sense of the word. And what they did was they decided the Soviets would look around this country and see if there were any natural resources. And so they sent out surveying teams. And they fitted them out with medical kits, and they fitted them out with maps, and they fitted them out with tools, and they fitted them out with food, and they fitted them out with vodka. If they had not given them the vodka, they probably would have discovered the astonishing energy and mineral wealth that has been discovered since the Soviet Union collapsed. Astonishing and obvious. Alcohol costs money. And now Mongolia, money's pouring in because they've got the world's largest copper mine. They've got or copper deposit. They've got gold, they've got silver, they've got a little bit of gas, oil, they have uranium, they have iron, and they're right next door to China. They were happier when China wasn't looking at them and licking its lips. Mongolians no longer need a passport to travel to China, which they hate, because when they enter China, the Chinese say, "You don't worry, you are our next province. You are welcome into China. You are Chinese." So, a country of 3 million next to a country of 1.3 billion, and there will be conflict as things are more and more constrained. We need energy supplies, oil and gas. Coal should be there too. Water, we went through extensively last night. Water is being commoditized more vigorously than any other natural resource right now. Geniuses on Wall Street have spent years and years and years looking ahead, seeing all these things we're talking about tonight, completely not putting a spiritual interpretation on it, and deciding where it was that they could put the chokehold so that people had to pay them money in order to live. A Wall Streeters' dream. If they could, they'd put their hand over the mouth of the poor and charge by the breath. And water is being claimed, being pumped, especially in developing nations. This is the Adra guy in me coming out, sorry. But in developing nations, international companies are drilling wells, dramatically lowering the aquifer so that village wells that have been productive for hundreds of years are pumped dry, and then they sell the water back to the villagers, bottle by bottle by bottle. And since the villagers can't afford it, people who were not previously sick get sick, It's just a downward spiral. But the companies are making money, so you know, everything's okay. Land and seafood, we covered that extensively last night. The fact that our ocean system is crashing, the fact that our land-based system is crashing, our food production system, but on top of that, our oceans will be virtually 100% fished out in 25 years or less for a variety of reasons. 1 billion people have to transition from a seafood-based diet to a land-based diet, putting astonishing extra pressure. Nations have to have it, and nations will fight for it. When everything's hunky-dory, when the gas tank is full, everybody's friends, we can afford to be diplomatic. But when we run into resource constraints, we immediately run into conflict. That's just how it is. Matthew 24, 6 through 8. Ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. Nation shall rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. Meaning, well, we're going to look at that. We're going to unpack that later. I guess I shouldn't start into that. But what we are seeing is very concrete progression toward the complete fulfillment of prophecy. And in piecemeal, we're seeing entire countries that are, we see a growing list of countries that are completely fulfilling the prophecy that Christ made in Matthew 24. All right. We've looked at oil. We've looked at, in a very cursory manner, I apologize, it was too short, but we've looked at resource shortages. Probably you read enough headlines that the resource shortages should be obvious to you. We're going to look at man's global financial system. And this is just such an appropriate picture. By the way, anybody who wants a copy of my PowerPoint presentations last night and today, all you have to do is give me a card with an email address on a scrap of paper, whatever. I'd be happy to send them out. Anything I can do to spread the word that Jesus is coming soon and why I am convicted that he is. So, our global financial system, and that's what it is, global, is absolutely not separate from the natural world that God created. It is absolutely built on the natural world that God created. When an entire inland sea dries up, such as we've seen in Chad, and in the Aral Sea, and increasingly in the Caspian Sea, when a significant resource goes away, you get complete economic disruption. Lake Chad, 4 countries relied on Lake Chad, 20 million people relied on Lake Chad for their life and their industry, their economy, and over the course of 50 years, that lake shrunk by 97% because the Sahara Desert is expanding. Desertification is going on. So, when it comes to our industrial society around the world, we've got to have the fresh water. We've got to have a functioning ecosystem. We've got to have the supply of food to feed the workers. It's all tied together. We like to think that we're separate. We've got our air-conditioned buildings. We've got our comfort. We've got our cars. We've got our Bose stereo. We've got our earphones. We've got our entertainment. We've got a big screen TV. And nature's out there. But that's not the way it is. We're sitting 4 square on top of these systems that are in accelerating decline, including our financial system. In fact, financial system is an early warning. As these global systems become more unstable, our financial systems become more stressed and more unstable. Now, who can name me a country that has a sound financial system? I heard something. China. No offense. But China's about the last one. Having lived and worked there, I mean, yeah, they're a big growing economy, but they are...
Bolivia.
Well, if someone said Switzerland, I might give you that one. But you know what? That's other people's money to begin with. It's not like they have their own huge economy. They've got other people's money, and since other countries are failing, I'm not sure that counts. China... And again, no offense, but having lived and worked there, it is such a sham. It is such a house of cards. There is so much financial deception in the world's ultimate mammonist society, where money is more than worshipped. I don't know what more than worship would be, but it is the center of the entire society, tragically. So many Chinese companies that I worked with, very large, state-owned companies, big companies, more than billion-dollar companies, meeting with high officials. Well, I was working for an international biorefinery company up in Montreal, flying back and forth to China, meeting with Chinese companies, and the usual conversation goes like this. We like your technology. We can get money, a lot of money from the government, and we can start building factories, but they need to know that your technology has advanced to this point, which it hasn't yet. So you need to tell them it has. You need to lie, and we'll give you the words. You just sign the paper. Oh, and we'll need to have some scientists sign off. We have them ready, no problem. And we're a little concerned about your capitalization, but we know some people in Montreal that can make it look really great. I mean, the conversations were astonishing, blatant. China financially is a house of cards. So much trickery going on at every level, which, of course, is what caught up ultimately with Lehman Brothers a little bit. And it wasn't a big thing either. But that was enough to trip Lehman Brothers, and that was enough to trip up a system and put us into a descending spiral that started the Great Recession. That is nothing compared to what will happen if China really trips. House of cards. The U.S.? No way. We added trillions and trillions of dollars of debt just over our wars, and not including the debt we're taking on trying to swim our way out of this recession. What the economists hope will turn into an inflationary scenario, so we can inflate our way out of this recession now that we've spent all of this money and dug a really deep hole. The EU? No way. There isn't a country of significant size that has a stable financial system. Maybe Bhutan. Sorry? The Vatican? No way. No way. We can get into that discussion later. But they've made some headlines recently about the levels of corruption and deception. Japan? No. Nobody is healthy. At the same time, our global systems are in decay, putting extraordinary pressure on human society. We're getting more and more erosion in our global financial sector. Now, the global financial sector is interlinked. We got this idea that if we all joined elbows and stood together and grabbed the shoulder of the guy in front of us and grabbed the shoulder and back, that we would all be so stable if we're all connected. Problem with that is we've come to find that if there's one irresponsible idiot in the bunch who falls down, everybody goes. And so we are less stable by being globally interconnected than we ever were being alone. It's designed to be shockproof, and instead it's incredibly fragile. Some irresponsible country, whether it's Portugal or Ireland, they call them pigs. Portugal, Ireland, Greece, and Spain, P-I-G-S. Country, well, but it's actually pigs because it's Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece, and Spain. Thank you. So here's the thing. We put our faith in money. We chase it all the time. It's the metric we use to measure our status in the world. We watch money, unfortunately. But the people who watch money, the people whose lives are dedicated to money, are people who are going to be so distraught in the days ahead because this primary metric, this measurement that they use, this thing that they chase all the time, is becoming more and more and more unstable as the world becomes unstable. No extra money to pay for disasters or adaptation. We talked about climate shift last night, and about how society is built on assumptions, and where we put our power grid, where we put our roads, where we put our houses, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, where we put our crops, all based on assumptions. And when those assumptions become invalid because of a shift in this system, it costs, it's a huge burden to society because we've got to rebuild, we've got to replace, we've got to relocate, whether it's our agriculture or anything else. We don't have the money to pay for adaptation. Superstorm Sandy, $65 billion was the last figure I heard. I mean, before that, it was just $50 billion, so that figure's inflated. I don't know what's going on there. But we'll be talking about disasters here pretty quick and how they are increasing at an astonishing rate. And they are already a financial burden globally to society, a huge drag on our, well, significant drag anyway, at this point on our global society. Complex society. Here we are. Equals fragility. So if you, now raise your hand if this applies to you, if you grow all your own food, you buy or trade with no one else, if you grow the fibers, whether it's plant or animal, if you grow the fibers to make all of your own clothing, you make your shoes yourself, you rely entirely on your own transportation and whatever you use for transportation, you made yourself with materials that you gathered yourself. If you rely on no one else for anything else, you don't live in a complex society. Raise your hand. Never had anyone raise their hand. Anyway, if you're good at one thing or two things and you do that and you're compensated for it and you trade through cash or credit card for everything else you need, then you're a full-fledged card-carrying member of a complex society. And that's just how we do it. This is just, whether you call it sinful society, call it human nature, call it whatever you want, but this is what societies do. We specialize and we use technology. Now, you may not think of what the Roman Empire did as technology, but technology is that little edge over everyone else. When they had bows that shot a little farther, when they had shields that were a little stronger, when they had elephants that went a little further, they had a technology advantage and they ruled the world. In the same way we pursue technology, we've got technology that would dazzle them, but technology is technology. If the world lasts another 100 years, they'll be looking at our medical equipment up here that costs so much. Oh, that's so quaint. You know. Oh, look at that antique. The day will come. Everything gets old. But the problem with complex society is that it absolutely requires specialists. As it grows, the problems a complex society faces become more and more and more complex, more and more and more difficult, more and more and more expensive. And the problem, the solutions, likewise, become more and more and more expensive. Related always to population growth and resource shortages, this is what always buckles the knees of a complex society. Resource shortages, including capital, including money in that category. But we require more and more specialists who come up with more and more complicated solutions to more and more problems, which cost more and more money. Eventually, the middle is squeezed through a tremendous tax burden, and the system begins to fall down. People begin to say, these tax rates are absolutely crazy. You know, in other societies, it might have not have been tax rates. It might have been the fact that the empire needed their children and their money. But the point is the same. The system requires so many resources from the bottom of the pyramid that it begins to crumble. When you take a look at complex societies, the state of the world right now, we are in a pre-collapse state. We are teetering on the brink. And we could be triggered on a global basis by any number of things. We, for the first time in known history, because we don't know what happened before the flood, for the first time in known history, we have a global complex society that's never happened before. We're all joined together. We're all linked together with financially, with technology, with trade. We're one, for better or worse. And we could be the trigger in beginning a slow collapse, and it's not like, you know, boom, the curtain drops. The dismantling of a global complex society could be triggered by anything, anywhere, in the world. Now, the guy that wrote the book on this is Joseph Tainter. He wrote The Collapse of Complex Societies, very academic book. If you have trouble sleeping, I highly recommend this book. But fantastic. I mean, fascinating if you can get through it. And important if you can get through it. Joseph Tainter, Collapse of Complex Societies, who, with his usual simplicity and straightforwardness, said the root cause of the collapse of complex societies is a consistent overinvestment into complexity in an environment of declining marginal returns. So now that we've solved that question, what that really means is that the society faces problems that are larger and larger, requiring more and more resources from that society, and with less and less of an impact. And eventually, it's like the problems have become too big for us to afford. We can't figure this out. We're going to have to cut someplace because no one's got any money left to tax anyway. We're very, very close to that. Our complex society is in advanced stages of resource depletion and spiraling complexity. We're in a pre-collapse state. That's where we are. And this pushes us towards conflict, because a complex society will go to war before it accepts collapse. We need more phosphate. We need more phosphate rock. We have to have it. And you know, there aren't that many Canadians up there. It wouldn't be that tough, you know. Countries are either pulled or pushed towards conflict as we become more and more unstable on a global basis, and the gloves come off. You look, if you're a powerful nation, and you take. And we're already beginning to see it. The number of trigger points are many. So, we've got this arc of growth in a complex society. Maturity, decline, collapse. We're cresting on maturity. We're beginning to climb. It plays into this converging, this set of converging forces that the world has never seen before. All of these problems that we don't have a solution for. In the end, it's like a global Ponzi scheme. Because a global complex society, in order to keep going, has to get many things from developing nations. Has to get brain power. Some of you are here because of opportunities where you could go from a developing nation to a developed nation. Didn't realize you were getting into such problems. It was better back where you were, but in some senses. But some people are here because you bring intellectual capital to a society that needs it. Not only that, but we need developing nations, we need their resources. They've got to feed our engine. And they need to buy some of our stuff. They need to buy more and more and more stuff. It's like a Ponzi scheme. It does come to the point of collapse. If we don't have the inflow of intellectual, financial, and resource, and natural resources, our society comes under more and more and more strain. And so, therefore, it's a very serious thing when nations reverse their development course. Libya. Egypt isn't quite reversed yet, but they're coming up on it. Haiti, oh my goodness, always a troubled country, really bad right now. Sudan, Mali, Syria, Madagascar. Around the world, there are 15 nations who have completely reversed course and have completely fulfilled the conditions Christ described in Matthew 24, verses 6 through 8. That's a big deal. And that list, and there are many, many more nations that are poised, ready to join this list. And it's happening before our eyes. It's happening on our watch. We are products of a complex society, and so we always ask this question. There's always an engineer, or four, or ten, in the audience, and while I'm talking, they're figuring out, okay, well, yeah, agriculture, okay, so we'll have hydroponics. Forget the fact that hydroponics still need phosphate. Oh, well, anyway. A lot more solar energy. But solar energy, we can't make all the stuff, all the plastic, all the carpet, all the fibers. So we're going to need, well, we'll have some bio. So they're thinking this stuff out. But the answer is no. Technology is used in the growth phase of a complex society. It really works. When you get to maturation and begin decline, technology, the low fruit has been picked. And everything else comes at declining marginal rates. It costs so much money to implement your solution, it's either hardly worth it or not worth it at all. That's where we are now. I compare the Earth to an airplane. And 7 billion people on that airplane. A few people know that that airplane's going to crash. And they're either trying to get the other passengers off, or they're ignoring the situation. But they know it's going to crash, and they know how to get off that plane. Every one of the other 7 billion people on that plane are entirely engaged, kicking, fighting, scratching, working, sweating, to get an upgrade from coach to business. From business to first class. They want the very best seat when that plane hits the ground and kills everyone who isn't off. It's insane. And it's the world. You guys know how to get off that plane. Are we as a church and as individuals entirely focused on trying to tell people who are extraordinarily distracted and entertained and not that interested, are we trying to tell people that their plane is going to crash, that they will die? Get off the plane or die. Will they think you're crazy? Yes. Happily, that's really not what we should be telling them. Our message should be about Jesus. Telling people about what we're discussing today is not a winning strategy, brothers and sisters. I'm here talking to you because the Adventist Church needs to wake up, and because I'm passionate on this subject. And because, especially within the Adventist understanding, I can point to prophecy in Scripture, I can point to prophecy in Spirit of Prophecy, I can point to what's going on and say, brothers and sisters, do you agree? Once the dots are connected, do you agree time is short? And I can ask the question, are we doing what we need to do? But when it comes to talking to people about what's coming, it doesn't work. We have to talk about who's coming. That works. It's the only thing that really works. Scaring people into the church is a waste of time and resources, part of the devil's plan. Physical Earth and human society, locked in an accelerating decline. The two are inseparable. With all of our society, with all of our institutions, with all of our wealth, on a global basis, we're still built on planet Earth. And with sin, the cumulative effects of sin, and we spent a lot of time last night, those of you who weren't here, we spent a lot of time building the case with Scripture and Spirit of Prophecy for sin affecting the physical Earth. If you didn't see that, you're missing a foundation here. But sin affects the physical Earth, and we're seeing the results of sin. That's the name of my book, Planet in Distress. Well, it's been a while since I looked at it. You'd think I'd remember this. Environmental Deterioration and the Great Controversy. In my defense, I named it something else, but the publisher, in their wisdom, and I think it was wisdom, they chose a different name. So, this is the path we're on. And everyone on Earth, especially and including Adventists, are hindered by normalcy bias. In the whole history of the world, Christ has never come. Therefore, he won't come right away. Normalcy bias. What is normal will continue. This is cognitive state that we are all in. We have to overcome this cognitive state. We have to watch so that we can see the signs. When we see the signs and become convicted that Jesus really is coming and he really is coming soon, then we get to the point where we take action. In the meantime, it's easy to nod and say, that's very interesting. Yeah, some interesting facts there. And go right back because of normalcy bias. Because this is how we think. And it's comforting. Except that when it turns out we're wrong, what happens is denial, of course, a lot of that going on, accompanied by a total lack of preparation, accompanied by panic and then anger. Why didn't someone tell me? Don't go there. Okay. We keep looking in the Christian community, certainly in the worldwide Christian community, and probably in the Adventist community, very much probably in the Adventist community, we keep looking for one event. Does anybody remember this whole ridiculous thing? Now, you didn't know any Adventists that were caught up in this, did you? Weren't getting any emails, were you? You know, we get caught up in thing after thing after thing. This is the Pope. This is the one. Oh, this is the one. I can see it coming. Okay, how many of you have heard that about six times? Right? Well, you're not old enough, but you've only heard it once or twice. This is the... Look at Gorbachev. He's got this stain on his head. That's the mark of the beast. Man, do we lose credibility quickly. This is loony. You know, it's as if... And then there's conspiracy theories. The government controlling the weather and has these secret bases, and there's black helicopters and they have underground tunnels and they've got massive troops and they're buying up all the ammunition. It's as if the great controversy between Christ and Satan wasn't enough. We've got to have something else. We get distracted. We waste time. We talk to people about ludicrous things and not about Jesus. This is Satan's game. So we keep looking for big things, but in fact, it's the little things that matter. I'm kind of convinced that those quarters are glued together. I just, you know, my understanding of the laws of physics say that that's not quite possible. But anyway, maybe it's because I stretched the photo to fit the screen. I don't know. But it's each small event that matters. It's not we're going to get hit, bang, with one big thing. It's an accumulation of things that are happening while we're watching. This is a welder's apron. I ripped this off the internet from a company that sells welder's aprons. It's $29 if you want to go get one, plus shipping, I assume. It's made out of split cowhide, and it's got double reinforced seams, according to the company that's selling it. When it's used for welding. And when that molten metal, when you get something in there, sparks fly. And the sparks hit the leather apron, and they don't hurt the person who's welding. They leave a little mark, a little tiny mark. Spheroid molten metal hits the leather, leaves a little mark, and goes away. Sometimes when there's a bigger piece of metal, leaves a bigger mark on that welder's apron, but it was made strong. It was made thick. It was made tough. It was made to do its job. Just as God created the world in perfection and made it resilient and made it balanced so it could do its job. But this apron, the reason they're still selling them is because they wear out. Enough little pinholes in that apron, and pretty soon it's got actual holes in it. The molten metal gets through. Isaiah 51:6. For the heavens will vanish away like smoke. The earth will grow old like a garment. And those who dwell in it will die in like manner. Thankfully, there's a promise in that verse. But my salvation will be forever, and my righteousness will not be abolished. This world, compared to what it was created as, is barely grinding away. It is so full of holes. And that's where we are right now while we're watching. So, when will it get bad? As if it's not already. When will it get bad? I'd say for somebody it got pretty bad. But let's look at this. Now, I am not, emphatically not predicting when Christ will come. I think he'll come in my lifetime. Yes, if you heard the sermon this morning, so did my great-grandmother, grandmother, and father, some of whom were wrong. I might be wrong. In his mercy, God might further delay so that the maximum number of people can be saved. What I am going to talk about is the impact on society of declining global systems, and we're going to get to disasters as well. And on the current trend we're on, when it gets, according to my research, according to what I've looked at, and these are my opinions, okay, they didn't come from someplace, that's come from research, someone else's research. But when society as we have it now becomes untenable, looking at the percentage of resource depletion on this graph, well, red is bad. Okay, blood red is really, really, really bad. Blue is good. You get into the pink, it's uncomfortable, increasingly uncomfortable. We're talking about aquifers, which we discussed at length last night, phosphate rock, and fisheries. Something that affects, well, because of the phosphate and our global industrial food system, something that affects just about everybody on Earth. A few tribes in Papua New Guinea, a few hill tribes, but everyone else is affected by these things. It's normal human tendency to look at this and say, 2040, hot dog, party on. I'll be dead. Doesn't matter. But that's not what I see. With the impact that we're seeing, I just don't see how we make it to 2030. I'm not saying that's when Christ comes. God has tarried, has delayed the coming of Christ. Only He knows the day or the hour. And that tarrying could carry on for some time. There's a whole lot of things I don't know, a whole lot of things I don't see. But based on the information I have available to me now, I don't see how we make it past here. Certainly, between here and here, we've got profound human suffering. People that we would like to evangelize, and frankly, it's really bad in a lot of places now. People that we should be evangelizing will die. Opportunities will be lost. If you look at this and say, I don't see any personal pain coming until, you know, back here, that's not the point. The point is that every day it gets harder and harder and harder to carry out the mission that Christ gave us. And that's where we are right now. Global system degradation, and here you see our systems, oceanic, atmospheric, food production, climate, and fresh water, on their known tracks of degradation as I have researched them, with ocean being absolutely the worst. And the thing is, brothers and sisters, I don't think ocean's actually the worst. It is the most extensively measured. We have the most data and the most experience going back hundreds of years with the ocean. We don't have that with the atmosphere. We don't have that with the climate. We don't have that with food production, though we're catching up with food production data. So ocean is in a class by itself, but I strongly suspect that the others are up there anyway. And we're coming out of blue into pink and into traumatic and disastrous times. The thing that interests me as I look at more and more projections that other people are making for resource depletion, for difficulties, is that they, this is mildly exponential, but they all match. They all have an exponential growth, and they all have about a 25-year timeline. And they all end in really bad situation. We're talking very credible studies, some of which you saw last night. Ocean fisheries, for instance. So when will we see global devastation? Well, we won't, not before the close of probation. It'll get difficult. It'll get uncomfortable. And the Bible says, except those days were shortened, no one would live. But these systems aren't going to crash completely. They're just going to get worse and worse and worse. And Matthew 24, 6 through 8 will be progressively fulfilled. In the U.S., however, we'll see unprecedented levels of disasters. I want to read this to you. Men in responsible positions will not only ignore and despise the Sabbath themselves, but from the sacred desk will urge upon the people the observance of the first day of the week, pleading traditions and custom in behalf of this man-made institution. They will point to calamities on land and sea, to the storms of wind, the floods, the earthquakes, the destruction by fire, as judgments indicating God's displeasure, because Sunday is not sacredly observed. The calamities will increase more and more. One disaster will follow close upon the heels of another, and those who make void the law of God will point to the few who are keeping the Sabbath of the fourth commandment as the ones who are bringing wrath upon the world. Ellen White, Southern Watchman, June 28, 1904. So, where are we on natural disasters? Well, it ain't good. I want you to look at this graph very carefully and with some skepticism, please. 1920, 1930, 1940, 1950, no real growth, right? But, brothers and sisters, let's be wise as snakes and innocent as doves. Reported disasters per year. What was going on in the Amazon? Or in Siberia? Or in Mongolia? Or in China? That didn't make it into the New York Times, that didn't make it into a database. A lot. This is not a reliable number. Not reliable in the 1930s, though we're getting a little better. Not reliable in the 1940s. After World War II, we're doing a better job. 1960, 1970, you know what? We're getting a lot better at understanding what's going on around the globe. 1980, CNN. I think we can use 1980 as our baseline for normal. Or maybe 1976, pick a year. But that's that increase that you see, that astonishing increase that you see, is not the result of a few disasters in the Amazon becoming known. Around the world, we're seeing more and more and more disasters, and they are becoming larger and larger and larger. These calamities will increase more and more. One disaster will follow close upon the heels of another, and this will usher in the Sunday law, something that should really wake us up. But even right now, we're choosing our path. This lukewarm Laodicean church, there are those who are becoming cold, and there are those that are becoming hot, and we are stopping being Laodicean. It's happening slowly. Now, what does it take to have people who are waiting for the opportunity to call for a Sunday law? We need to heal the land. Let's go to the minor prophets. We need to honor the Lord. We need to keep the Lord's day. You can practically hear the argument. But would that argument resonate after Superstorm Sandy? No. No, it wouldn't. After Superstorm Sandy and after the very large tornado in Oklahoma City, we had about 3 weeks where it remained in our consciousness. About 3 weeks. Large disasters make about a 3-week impression on us. People who, right after the Superstorm Sandy, were saying, we shouldn't build here again. This is insane. Almost everything is being rebuilt. Lots of money pouring in. Willing investors. Insurance companies going, ooh. So the U.S., in order for the disasters to happen close enough that we had a continual impression on us, the U.S. would need to see at least a tripling of disasters from our current level when the world has already seen a tripling of disasters in the last 30 years. When the world has seen a tripling of disasters in the last 30 years. The U.S. has seen more. This is a FEMA chart, declared disasters, going back to the 1960s. You can see the exponential growth line. I couldn't find an up-to-date chart, but I could get the up-to-date numbers. 2011, 99 declared disasters. Starting in 1980 at 25 declared disasters, and going to 2011, 400%. 300% in the world, 400% in the United States. Down in 2012, but not off the trend line, and it looks like we'll don't know, 70, 80 disasters. We get more in the fall. And we haven't seen that yet. Fires, especially, inflate those numbers. So we're told that in the United States, calling for the National Sunday Law, it's going to be an increase in disasters. We need to see approximately a tripling from this number, or a smaller number but very large disasters. If we had four, it's July. If we had four hurricanes, four massive fires, two tornadoes, and an earthquake, that would fill up the calendar. All of that is possible. Lord willing, I hope it doesn't happen. But this is the track we're on. We're rapidly approaching the time of little trouble. I have a couple copies of this if you want it. Someone put an awful lot of time and effort into this, an Adventist pastor. We're in the shaking time. We are building up to the time of the Sunday Law. After that, the time of little trouble before the close of probation. We are seeing in real time the buildup to the fulfillment of prophecy and the actual fulfillment of prophecy that would have astonished the people who founded this church. We're watching, we're seeing, we may or may not be comprehending, but it's all there, and we're not even awake. That said, you folks are more awake than my usual Sabbath afternoon audience, because usually I do Friday night, and then I do church, and then we have potluck, and then I do a 2 o'clock seminar, and these poor people in a warm church with a full stomach. It's so nice to look out and see that 70% are asleep. Really, it's very gratifying. Thank you. Appreciate it. How many of you, like me, took a nap before you came here? Oh, this room is wise. Yeah, good use of time. Christ's prophecy in Matthew 24, 6 through 8. Look at this. Haiti, Syria, Mali, Chad, Madagascar, Sudan, Libya, Pakistan, Equatorial Guinea, Eritrea, North Korea especially, oh my goodness, Egypt, Libya, Somalia, sorry, Western Sahara, South Ossetia, which is Soviet Georgia. Wars and rumors of wars, famine, pestilence, earthquakes. We're going to talk about earthquakes in a minute. But even these end-time events that we see rushing at us show a merciful God. Remember, the great controversy is about the character of God being on trial in front of the universe. You want the big picture, that's what it is. It's the character of God. And my argument is that even what's coming is a sign of a merciful God. To understand that, let's go back to Exodus. So, the Egyptian plagues. Parallels between Egyptian plagues and end time events. Striking parallels. This is John Martin, fantastic artist, at his peak in the 1820s, hangs in the Tate Museum in London, well, in UK anyway. Astonishing. He did Bible scenes, and he did them grandly. This doesn't do it justice at all. The plagues. Perhaps you are aware that the plagues systematically crushed, and not just crushed, but humiliated the gods of the Egyptians. The Israelites didn't know God. They had lost him. He was communicating. He was establishing himself. I am greater than these gods that you know. I am God. I am Yahweh. He was telling them about himself and telling us. And he didn't just, well, there's a sense of humor to some of this stuff. He didn't just crush them. Like I say, he humiliated them, made the gods a laughingstock. So God differentiated himself, he defined himself, and he also showed that he keeps his word and follows through on what he says he will do. So God turned their gods into curses. So one of their gods was frogs. Now, how many of you, next time you look at a Chinese restaurant, okay, and I love, oh man, I loved working in China, I love Chinese food, I love Chinese culture, except for the financial stuff. But look at their phone number. What number do they get as many times as they possibly can into their phone number? Chinese restaurants, every one of them will try and get a custom number. What number is it? No, close. Eight. Luck. Eight is luck in China. Interesting enough, in China, there's no fourth floor, just as we in commercial buildings have no 13th floor. There was an American-designed hospital in China that had four floors and four wards, and each ward had four beds. And so it would be floor one, ward two, bed one. And then there was floor one, floor four, ward four, bed four. Three floors, absolute death. Four is death in Chinese, in Chinese numerology. And 444, people would, even if they were brought in by an ambulance and were bleeding, if they were introduced into that bed, they would crawl home. So luck is a big deal in the Chinese culture, and luck is a big deal, was a big deal, a huge deal in the Egyptian culture. If you saw a frog, just like seeing a four-leaf clover, oh, luck, I'm going to have a good day, I saw a frog, lucky frog. Well, yeah, lucky frog, until they're in your closet, and your bed, and your food, and you're overwhelmed with them, and they're absolutely everywhere, good luck turned into horribly bad luck. The Egyptians believed that there were gods here and gods there, gods everywhere. One of those gods was the god of the air. Flies were his ears. When a fly was close, that god was close. And he was listening and could maybe help you. Well, they liked to see flies because that was the, yeah, I know. Because that was the presence of, I mean, don't get me started about black flies in Maine. Just, they make us crazy. I'm part crazy. I'm going to go there. But I can sympathize with a sparrow. This is what it's like when I go out into my backyard. It's like, get away from me, black flies. It's horrible. We hate this time of year. And they turned the god into a curse. Well, now what happens in the end times turns our gods into curses? The things that we worship, the things that we use to separate ourselves from God, the things that we pursue instead of God, entertainments, money, pleasures, status, vanity. What will come, what is coming, what is starting now is the destruction of our gods, the disassembling of our gods. Everyone on earth will have a quiet moment. You all know what it's like when the power goes out. Lived in Mongolia, power is always going out. But you know what it's like when the power goes out and you didn't know your house was so noisy, right? It's like, whoa, it is so quiet in here. The air stopped moving. Everybody will have that quiet moment when the gods that we are pursuing don't have our attention, and later become a curse to us. In his mercy, God is taking our gods away. This is part of what's happening in the end time. And if your life is focused on those gods, if your energy is towards pleasing those gods or gaining more of them, well, this is Melbourne, by the way, nothing against Melbourne. So our gods will become a curse. Oops, already have. Gods will become a curse. People that have pursued vanity and built up a tremendous debt will be incredibly distressed in the days ahead. We are not supposed to enter these days in debt. So the bridegroom has tarried in mercy. We think, oh, come on, God, come. It's horrible. But there is this balance where the absolute maximum number of people will be saved, and that's when Christ will come. At the same time, the earth will only be allowed to go so far. I guess I shouldn't say the absolute number of people, because then it could go on for forever. But the earth will be allowed to slide only so far, and there are these lines that cross. We don't know when that is, but we are supposed to watch. We are supposed to know, kind of, when it is. Don't know the day or the hour, but we're supposed to know the signs. And they are there in abundance. This tarrying time is almost over. we can see if disasters keep growing exponentially as they have because of the effect of sin on our global systems, if disasters keep growing as they have, we can see the Sunday law from where we're standing. But brothers and sisters, if seeds are going to sprout, they need to be planted well ahead of time. Now's the time to work. Trying to get someone's attention when it's obvious to us that we finally should be working, we will have wasted the time, the tarrying time when our Savior expected us to be working. Looking at Matthew 24:68, ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. So as we see systems accelerate in their decline, as we see pressure on human society, as we see resource shortages, as we see the maturation and beginning decline of our global complex society, all of these things are pushing nations or pulling nations to conflict. They're either being pushed or being dragged in, kicking and screaming very reluctantly, like Mongolia. We'll see these signs, but we are not to be troubled. These things must come to pass. There is a great controversy. There is a progression of events. God's character must be justified. Satan's system must be shown to be fatally flawed, to be fundamentally corrupt, to be completely lies. Now, hey, I'm convinced, and I think everyone else in the universe is, but there will be no basis for questioning. Satan will have no excuse. These things must come to pass because of what's going on in the bigger picture where God is on trial. But the end is not yet. No, probation has to close. We have to stand. These things have to happen. Nation shall rise against nation. That's wars between states. Kingdom against kingdom. That's wars within states or within people groups. Tremendous amount of conflict must happen. There shall be famines. If you were here last night and you looked at our global food production system, hopefully this just jumps out at you. We see it coming. Pestilences. Certainly this is consistent with what's expected in a climate shift scenario. Those of you who have heard of the Dust Bowl in the 1930s, really dried out. You all heard of that, right? Now, unless you're like an epidemiologist, unless you have some archaic knowledge, you probably don't know that there was a huge epidemic of chest disease. What would you call that? I want to say pulmonary, but that's not it. Anyway, there were these respiratory disease. In many cases undiagnosed, in many cases undiagnosable. But we're beginning to see it again. When we get these huge dust storms in the Southwest, the emergency rooms are flooded. And when there were huge dust storms throughout the Dust Bowl, especially the young, especially the old, succumbed. A tremendous number of deaths. They didn't know what it was. We're not supposed to breathe the stuff that's in the soil. When you get a shift in climate, situations change, you get more pestilence. These pressures work somehow. I can't explain it to you, but we'll see it. Earthquakes in diverse places. Now, when I began, this one really puzzled me. I didn't know what to say. I was saying, well, Satan cannot keep in balance what God created. So that was the best I could do. And then I read a book. I bought a book, $30, called Waking the Giant. Embarrassingly, I forget the name of the guy who wrote it. But suffice it to say, the book is about 70% evolution and billions of years and things like that. I bought the book so you don't have to. But his basic thesis is absolutely fascinating and fits perfectly. What he says is that the Earth is in a dynamic state. And it's, in other words, it's like a piece of plywood balanced on its side, just a little tiny breeze That's all it takes to tip that. Wham. Big things can happen and be triggered by real little things in a dynamic state. He says that when we pump the aquifers of the earth out, which we're doing, when the sea level rises, which it is, when the amount of water in the atmosphere increases, which it is, with the warming earth, when there's melting of the ice, Greenland and elsewhere, all of these things make a small change, massive change really, but relatively small change on the crust of the earth. And we are in a dynamic state, and he points to earthquakes that are triggered right now by small changes. He points to these things. And he says, the more we see declines in these global systems, or at least that's my phrasing of what he says, the more we see this stuff happen, the more we can expect to see earthquakes. And earthquakes beget earthquakes. He also says that something that's never seen before has started happening, and that is that the Pacific plate, starting in 2009, began to crack and fold. Earthquakes happen along the edge of the plates. And he says, this is astonishing. We saw a massive earthquake out there, and we're beginning to see this plate fold. And that means that every other plate on the surface of the earth is going to rearrange itself. Now, you'll see earthquakes with that. He says, don't worry, it'll be 20,000 years before that happens. We'll be long gone. Well, I work on a different time frame. But it's a fascinating book, and it provides a rationale that is much superior to the rationale I had previously. So, home stretch here, folks. With all that's coming on the world, what will you do? Does this information spur a response, or is it something that's interesting and intellectual? If we can really see Christ coming, does it mean that there should be a change in the way we lead our lives? What will you do? I have a couple suggestions. To prepare yourself. Develop and deepen a personal relationship with Christ so that you know Him as a friend. You know how it works. Something happens. At home, something mechanical happens. I'm not good with that. I call a friend. Hey, Todd, come on, help me. This thing happened on my car, and I don't, you know. And he says, oh, Scott, I'm coming. That's Todd. I know I'll call him. He was a deacon at the church that I lay pastored. Nice guy. Nice guy. He calls himself a pet gorilla. He can lift 400 pounds. Can lift an engine off the ground. Amazing. Nicest guy I've ever met. Or one of them anyway. And he comes and he helps me. He's my friend. Now, ideally, if something went wrong with my engine, I'd talk to Jesus, right? Yeah, ideally. But I call my friend. The point is, with what's coming on the world, we have to have Jesus as a friend. Not this intellectual concept. Not this distant God. Jesus has to be our friend. And He wants to be. It's not hard. He's waiting. You've all seen the picture. Knocking at the door. Patiently. He's just waiting for us to open the door. It's not that He's unapproachable. If Jesus is our friend, and by the way, a friend is someone who, when you call, you know that they will help. And you're looking forward to seeing them. If Jesus is our friend, we don't have any troubles. Well, we'll have troubles, but we'll make it through. Unless He chooses that we be one of the ones who are martyred. But if He's our friend, that doesn't matter. What matters is whether or not He's our friend. Number two, study the Bible and store it up in your heart. You've heard this. Scripture says it. Spirit of prophecy says it. But it's absolutely true. How can He be our friend if we're not reading His letters? Seriously. How can He be our friend if we're not reading His letters? Develop a vigorous prayer life. You know what I'm going to say. How can He be our friend if we're not talking to Him? A vigorous prayer life, not table grace. A vigorous prayer life where you're talking to your friend. and expecting a response. Familiarize yourself with prophecy and end time events. We have this incredible resource, Spirit of Prophecy, that inexplicably to me has lost its cachet in the Adventist church. It's like throwing wisdom out the door. I don't understand that. I just don't get it. But we are required, Spirit of Prophecy says, we are required to know the signs of the end. And they are available to us. It's not like they're inaccessible. What to do to prepare your family? Well, you need a really big gun. Decrease your dependency on the world. Now, that means decreasing entertainments. That means decreasing the extent to which we watch the world. Maybe it means planting a garden. This might not be the right audience to say that to, because I've seen my son's struggling little garden. Lives on Anderson Street. The poor thing is baked. Oh, wow. We may have black flies in Maine, but boy, at least we can grow stuff. And we don't have to water it. The rain does that. But anyway, it's interesting. We weren't told by Spirit of Prophecy to plant gardens in order to supply ourselves at the end time. We were told to plant gardens in order to put our hand in the soil, in order to see nature, in order to grow closer to our Savior. I know of no place in the Spirit of Prophecy where we're supposed to make provision so that we don't need God at the end of time. That's what the rest of the world is doing. We're not supposed to do that. Decrease your dependency on the world. How do you depend on the world? How can you distance yourself somewhat? Withdraw from the influences of the world, from its entertainments, from its diversions, from its distractions. Withdraw from the pursuit of things and the pursuit of celebrity. Get out of debt and practice simplicity. This is where my wife and I are at right now. Mortgage and everything. It's like crawling up the wall with just your fingernails. That's so tough. But it's so rewarding to make a little bit of progress. It's so difficult with kids going into college. Anyway, raise more of your own food. Spend more time in the garden or in nature. Again, as a spiritual growth strategy. As a spiritual growth strategy and as a health strategy. What to do to prepare your friends and neighbors? Draw so close to Christ that people can see Him in you. Step number one is not go down the street with the Bible and knock on all the doors. That ain't it. Work on yourself first. Draw so close to Christ. Have Him as a friend. Draw so close to Christ that people see Him in you. That will make a profound, profound difference. It'll make all the difference because it's Christ doing the work, not you. We are blunt tools. We are insufficient to the task. But with Jesus as our friend, with Jesus showing through us, we don't matter anymore. We're just the messenger. Hold up friends and neighbors in prayer and ask God to create opportunities for you to witness. So, number two, when you haven't gone out and knocked on any doors, Bible in hand. The shyest people in this room can do those first two things. Hold people up in prayer. Talk to your friend about them. Look for opportunities to witness. Give of yourself and interact frequently. I mean, come on. How can you just pop up with a friend or neighbor and want to talk about God? Oh, that's very credible. Yeah. Or your neighbor's out there with his garage. Hey, you got another paintbrush. I'd love to come. Oh, yeah, no, it's no problem. Come on, let's do this. Give me a paintbrush. Or whatever. Interact frequently. Give of yourself. Be a normal person. Not a stretch. We're normal people. You can read it yourself. Have those books and articles that you've actually read, not like the review that sits on your table until you know it's old enough that you can throw it away without feeling any guilt. 3 months, that's enough. You know, for those of us who occasionally have articles in the review, that's really depressing. But I should say very occasionally. I haven't had one in the review in a long time. So have these books and articles where you know what's in them. And when you're interacting, someone's talking, oh man, my brother has diabetes. Brother has diabetes. And I just don't know. And he's so worried. And this is exactly what I say in all the other programs. It's not just because you're here, Dr. Deal. Well, we've got this thing called the CHIP program. And some of diabetes can actually be reversed through diet. You know what? I got this great article. Let me get it for you. You've never... Oh, man, this is so cool. You've never heard about it. This could really help your brother. Boom. We have tremendous resources that just sit. But if you know people, if you've prayed for people, if you have Christ in you, you can do an astonishing work by simply handing out literature, magazines or books once in a while. And it's so intimidating to the people you're giving it to. They can thank you. They can throw it away. We can put it on their desk and wait until some prompt. They could take it home and read halfway through it. It's not intimidating. You being in their face I've seen people try and witness that buttonholed people, and I don't know why they have garlic breath, but they usually do. And it just doesn't work. It makes it harder for everyone else. Finally, offer to pray with people. When you know them well enough, when you've interacted with them, when you've prayed for them, when you've become a close friend with Christ, when you've worked on all these things, the Spirit will tell you when it's time to pray with them. It makes a profound difference when we pray with people. Amazing things happen. And if they say, yes, please pray with me, and you're praying for their brother with diabetes, just a quick prayer, and you're asking the Spirit, give me the words, please, because I just don't know. Astonishing things happen. Everybody here can do this. God works with blunt tools. There isn't anybody here. I have a son. My phone has been buzzing up here. I know it's him. He calls me all the time. He's 22 years old. His name is Nathan. He has Down syndrome. Great kid. Open heart surgery 2 months after he was born. Had a hole in his heart. Dr. Bailey, Dr. Rizuk. Fantastic kid. And probably the most effective witness in the family. I kid you not. He is not shy. When there's a cloudy day and the sun is shining through, and that's a lot in Maine, he will jump up and down. He'll get so excited. He'll point up. He'll say, Jesus is coming. God uses his kid. You've got more on the ball than my 22-year-old son. What keeps us back is what we think we're risking. Will we give our money for Christ? Yes. Will we give our time for Christ? Yes. Will we sacrifice our lives if we're called to be martyred? Yes. Will we be embarrassed for Christ? Oh. Expose myself to people and witness. And how can we say we do all these other things and we're not willing to be embarrassed for Christ? I don't understand that, brothers and sisters. I don't. A ministry for everyone. Now, everyone should have a ministry. And everyone should love it. It is possible for you to do something for Christ that is ideally suited to you, that you absolutely love. You're amped up about it. You want to do it. You wake up thinking about it. It should not be a drudgery. It should not be difficult. It should not be something that you dread. If it is, you're doing the wrong thing. You need to talk to God, talk to Christ more, and see what he assigns you to do. So here's just a few ideas that have to do Very close to the end here. Here's just a few ideas that have to do with some of the things we've been talking about. There are thousands of things you can do. What should you do? Ask your friend. Ask your friend Jesus. What should you be doing? Food price spiral, food price shortages. At my home church in Woodstock, Maine, we have a food bank. Used to be about 60 people would come on every third Tuesday of the month. Now it's about 300. And that's over the last 4 years, that growth. But, and it's you can't witness to those people. You know, I volunteer and my family volunteers and a lot of people volunteer. And you're just hustling around with boxes and carrying them out to cars and bless you, brother. And, you know, that's not witnessing. They know they went to a church. They know they got food. Boom, they're done. But some of those people, 1, 2, 10, would be willing to have help growing their own garden. Wow. Ellen White says that working in nature and growing a garden should be a spiritual experience. Now, people who haven't grown a garden before, first thing they need to do, they need to have the ground spaded up. Somebody has a rototiller, you've got a rototiller ministry. Okay? Bet you didn't think of that one. But here's the thing. If God calls you to this, and I'm not recommending it really, I'm saying God might call you to this. If God calls you to a gardening ministry and you're going to someone's house every week for 12 or 16 weeks, helping them plant, helping them nurture along, working with your hands in the dirt with them, you will know those people. By the time they harvest, you will have a relationship with them. When they harvest, they need to know what to do with it. Most people have no idea. Even the most modest churches in the Northern New England Conference, where I'm from, people with 15 members, these couple rows here, they have a little kitchen. And so preparing and preserving these foods, it's an obvious step. From there, inviting them into the church, it's an obvious step. Decreased healthcare availability and affordability. We have tremendous institutions globally. We've built up an amazing system which may or may not be what the spirit of prophecy said we should do. It could be that we lost our way and built something that is very good and effective, but not exactly what we were supposed to do. Brothers and sisters, we'll get another kick at that cat. In the days that are coming, in the days that are on us, where people, resources are more and more constrained, we will have an opportunity to practice very simple, very basic health care as outlined in Ministry of Healing, where we actually put our hands on the shoulders of sweaty people, you. But this low-tech, high-touch is what we were supposed to do. At least part of it. I'm not trying not to make negative remarks about this amazing thing that's been built up here, because I shouldn't be making remarks about it, negative remarks about it. And yet, there is another hand of this work that has been neglected. We get another kick at this cat. Is the Lord calling you specifically to this sort of thing? Being trained at Weimar, being trained at Uchi Pines, being trained at Wildwood, there's an astonishing abundance of material. Is the Lord calling you? Increased global catastrophes means community and international service opportunities. Basically, you could go to where there's real problems, and if you went there while Azure was there, it would be very hectic, it'd be very chaotic, you'd be in the way, but you'd be the only person praying with people. The Azure people are going nuts. They don't have time. Is the Lord calling you to this? How about increased question and hunger for answers? If you go to my blog site, planetindistress.com, I'll know you were there. I'll know what you looked at. I write maybe 2 articles a week, building on my book and commenting on current events. And I'll get somewhere between 10 and 150 visitors a day, page views a day, more accurately. And I wake up excited about this. I check, how many people from the Middle East and Turkey and the Soviet Union have visited my blog site today? How many people that I would never get a chance to witness to? There is a hunger for information. And if you're the type who would rather write and disseminate information than knock on doors, is God calling you to this? It cost me $27 to set it up, and $12 a year going forward, and a few hours, more than a few hours each week. But I love doing it. I love doing it. Gets me amped up. So, sin is destroying the world. Actual, physical world. Our complex society is fragile. We have resource constraints. We are in an accelerating decline in both the natural world and human society. Ours is the first generation to be able to see the fulfillment of prophecy in real time and to be able to forecast the fulfillment of prophecy, conflicts, famines in specific places. And what we see aligns with chapter 24 in Matthew and with chapter 36 in the Great Controversy. And brothers and sisters, it's become a cliche. Unfortunately, sadly, tragically, it's become a cliche. The church was founded by people who said, Jesus is coming, and meant it. And now we say, Jesus is coming someday. But brothers and sisters, from what I see, from what I've put together, my message for you today is that Jesus really is coming, and he really is coming very soon. You've been very patient. Thank you very much.
This media was brought to you by Audioverse, a website dedicated to spreading God's word through free sermon audio and much more. If you would like to know more about Audioverse, or if you would like to listen to more sermons, please visit www.audioverse.org.